Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. Tonight, I'm honored to bring you retro sci-fi and horror cinema with Brian Walker of Brian's Drive-In Theater. Greetings and welcome, Brian. How are you?
I'm well tonight, Hercules. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. A lot of interesting things are going on, and in this path of life, we never know where we're going to wind up. And this week, I find myself helping out with bringing together art auctions and golfing tournaments. I never thought I'd do those things in this lifetime. So amused, I guess.
Well, I enjoy both. So actually, that sounds like a lot of fun to me.
How about on your end? How are things with you?
Oh, okay. Our semester began on Tuesday here at West Virginia University. I'm teaching a synchronous online class this spring. And all that really means is I meet my class at designated times on designated days. Mm-hmm. It's an online class, but it's visual. We use Zoom. And I record my class sessions so that, you know, should a student, I have an attendance policy, but should a student not be able to log into the class, they can always watch the class later on.
And you'll know if they indeed locked in and listened to the whole thing?
Yeah, you know, I don't know how I would have felt as a college student about all the surveillance that current college students have to undergo. But it is comforting as a professor, yeah.
I've had that conversation several times in the past few days, so it seems to be on people's mind.
Well, and you know what? I'm to tell you the truth, I think I'm fortunate to have grown up during a time when you weren't watched constantly.
Yes.
I don't think I did anything. I don't recall doing anything so bad as to be worried about, you know, being seen. But you know what I mean. I'm not sure I'd want to be a young adult today, or even in my teens. I think when I grew up was the best time for me to grow up.
I'm in agreement. And again, I didn't do anything that would have made surveillance a problem either. But I'm glad that I didn't live in times like these when I was younger.
Yeah, I mean, I do think we probably had more fun. But you know what? It's interesting that we're talking about going back in time, because tonight I wanted to talk about science fiction and superhero film serials.
Oh, awesome!
You know, I was introduced to serials, you know, like a lot of people our ages, you know, as a kid on television. Some of the old serials, you know, were cut up into, you know, syndicated bits so they could be, you know, aired, you know, during the day, you know, on certain TV shows and so forth. And I've always loved them. We probably should define what a serial is before we get into this.
Okay.
Often, especially during the Depression, but even, you know, up to the 1950s, serials were produced by some of the, I don't want to say Poverty Row studios, although some of them did produce film serials, especially in the 1930s. But they were made by, you know, some of the lesser heeled, I guess might be the best way to say it, studios. And, you know, they did it in order to provide a lot of entertainment dollar for people who were coming in to see their movies. Serials were usually, you know, if you watched, you know, them episode, if you binge watched them, to use a new term, were usually 3 to 4 hours in total, but they were cut into small segments or episodes or chapters. Oftentimes they're referred to as chapters. And they were originally shown as the short subject when you went to the theater.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, when you went to the theater, you got a cartoon, a newsreel, a short subject, which was usually about 20 minutes or so, and that was usually a chapter in a film serial. And then you got one, sometimes even two features. So there was a lot of value for your dollar. And
yeah.
Film serials started, in the teens, but they really kind of reached their zenith in the 30s and 40s, because it was kind of hard to talk, the average working Joe out of a dime, back in during the Depression, because a dime was so hard to come by.
Mm.
But if you could, get them to walk into your theater, they were probably going to have 3 or 4 hours of entertainment, ahead of them. It was a really good value. Of course, the big studios didn't really do that. They didn't make serials. Some of the big studios had fantastic animation departments and made great cartoons, but the serials were predominantly made by some of the lesser studios. But that doesn't mean they're lesser films. It does mean that they're B movies,
right?
But they're so much fun to watch. When I was a teenager, I saw a lot of PBS primarily because I didn't have cable on my bedroom TV until I was in high school. But I did see a lot of PBS, and I believe it was on sometimes on Saturdays and sometimes on Sunday mornings. There was a PBS show that ran called Matinee at the Bijou. And I think it ran from, we'll say, the early 80s to the mid to late 80s. And it was brilliantly packaged. It was a PBS series. I can't remember, which city it was out of. And I can't remember the host's name. But he would come on, and it was kind of a large block of time, too. It was usually like 2-3 hours for each show. Matinee at the Bijou would run. The host would come on. He would introduce, the movie, what we were going to be watching, and then you would get the cartoon, the newsreel, the short subject, and then a feature. Like I said, largely all public domain, so it didn't cost PBS anything to produce this. I watched it religiously. Until I started working as a teenager, I watched it every weekend. I loved it. And that was sort of my second introduction, to serials. As I've gotten older, I've been able, and with the, advent of home video and later on DVD, I was able to actually watch, some of them. And there were quite a few of them made. And some of them were really quite good. Many of them were Westerns, and I would say the majority of film serials were Westerns. That's kind of how the genre picked up speed, especially coming into the 1930s. Westerns were always pretty inexpensive to shoot. You just had to have a decent piece of land and some horses and some guns and you were in a train and you were good to go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Science fiction movies are harder. They're more expensive to produce. I mean, you've got to the sets alone are expensive, and you can't just have a horse and the prairie, the open prairie, in order to make a movie. You've got to have some pretty interesting sets, and that's where I think the science fiction serials really come into their own. Some of them, given the fact that they didn't have much money, some of them really do give you kind of a sense of what did come in the future.
Right.
Some of them are pretty far off, but others are shockingly. So close to where we did end up. A lot of them involve space exploration and so forth, and some of them, even today, to sort of a more critical eye, still look pretty good. For example, right now I've got on the Batman and Robin serial from 1949.
Yes, I have that.
It's fantastic, and so many of us who grew up in the 60s remember Adam West and Burt Ward on the television series Batman, and I think that the series, since it's so it's ingrained in our culture even today, and that series is 55 years old this year.
Right.
which is kind of amazing to think that it's been that long. But if you go back and watch the old, you know, Batman and Robin serial from 1949, a lot of it is there. You know, a lot of what we remember seeing on the television show with Adam West is still is in this serial. So it's kind of it's interesting to go back and see, you know, how it was done. And to tell you the truth, they're only about 17 years apart or so. You know, there's not really that much time.
Mm-hmm.
Between the serial and the actual TV show, not that much time has elapsed, but the special effects are no different between the two.
Pretty much,
it's all rear projection. Some of the sets, I think, on the television show are more expensive, and the car is certainly different. I mean, that that beautiful George Barris Batmobile that Adam West got to drive. Is not present in the serial.
No.
Interestingly, in the serial, Batman drives a 1949 Mercury convertible, which is completely bone stock. I mean, there's nothing has been done to this car. They haven't altered even the hubcaps or anything like that. It's just a 49 Mercury convertible. So that's kind of an interesting way to look at it. Of course, the movie is from 1949, and that was a very futuristic-looking car. And I do wonder if you know, that car was chosen because it was a very attractive car. It had just shed pontoon fenders from the year before. You know, it looked much more modern. And I wonder if that's the reason that they just went with that particular model. I really don't know.
I don't know either, but there were two series I remember before the Adam West show, and it would be very shocking for a lot of modern people who didn't see Batman and Robin with guns, which seems to be okay in the serials.
That's a really good point, too. That's a great point to make. Batman always had his sort of MacGyver-esque litany of different things on his tool belt where he could get himself out of a scrape. But the 1940s Batman didn't always have things like that. It did have to resort to a lot more fisticuffs. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, my love of these old film serials goes, like I said, goes way back. And I haven't seen all of them. And unfortunately, a lot of the earlier ones are lost, which is such a shame.
Yes.
But a surprising number of the old serials did make it, primarily because a lot of them did cross over into TV.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the old film serials and then watch some early science fiction television programs, you can see where it all comes from. The episodic nature, the cliffhanger at the end of the episode, the recap at the beginning of the episode. I mean, you do see a lot of that, in early television.
Yes, you do. They seem to have shot them also where after a while it was easy to construct them into movies. So you had the serials and then they cut out the introductions and the part of the cliffhangers because it didn't always start on the same cliffhanger it ended on. Sometimes the interpretation was a little bit different. But they constructed them in such a way that when they finished the series with some editing, minor editing, they had a movie at the same time.
Right. And, depending on, the market, a lot of those were sent to Europe, Canada, Mexico, places like that, where they were, just edited down into some sort of digestible movie format of, let's say, 90 minutes or so. And the way they were shot, you could do that, but I hate to say it, but there in the serials there is a lot of extra footage that oftentimes you could cut out. Now they did have a lot, they did offer a lot of action and I don't mean to, belittle them in any way. But you have to stretch a story out to 3 to 4 hours. There's going to be some padding.
Yes.
You know, and but you see that in modern television shows as well. And, you know, quite honestly, if I hadn't built the drive-in theater website, the thing that was in the back of my mind, I had two different ideas at the time. I was either thinking about, you know, doing a B-movie website, or I was thinking about doing an early television website.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
The B-movie website, you know, that won out because I thought that there was more available content, and there was, you know, obviously. So much early television is gone. It's lost. It's actually worse than films, you know, quite honestly.
Yes, they recorded a lot of it, too.
Well, and you know, some of it was never recorded. You know, videotape wasn't a thing until, what, 56, 57, somewhere around there. And, you know, regular television broadcasts in America started right after World War II. I mean, most people didn't have a receiver, and it was largely based in New York. But it was there. I mean, it was present. It got started. It started making its way into the media, you know, and making more and more people want, you know, a television and, you know, a local television, a local television series. Not a station, I should say. And it's interesting that, you know, when serials really had their heyday, I want to say from the early 30s, probably through the late 40s, early 50s, when TV started, you know, taking hold. It took a while for television to make its way, you know, coast to coast. I mean, it took a while to build that network. Although, if you look back at the history of it, it's almost surprising how quickly it did take place. But it did take it a while. So a lot of areas, you know, didn't have, you know, television until, you know, well into the 50s, depending on how your location and how rural it was. But, you know, imagine seeing, Rocky Jones Space Ranger, in a magazine or, you know, a newspaper, if you didn't have access to TV. And Rocky Jones was a sci-fi DuMont television series from the 1950s, and it is still available. You'll see episodes of Rocky Jones on a lot of those Mill Creek sets that we always talk about.
Yes.
And you can find them online because they're largely public domain.
A lot of them weren't transferred to DVD. I like Rocky Jones, and that's one of the series that I love collecting. But they all, after like maybe a little bit more than halfway through, the collections didn't include the latter episodes. I believe I might have found some of them in movie form. I don't think I've seen all the episodes, even though for a while I was really intent on seeing them all.
You know, I agree with you. I don't think I've seen them all either. I have seen the ones that were edited into films, and there were a few of those.
Yes.
Available. But I think I agree with you there. I don't think I've seen all of them either. But they were inexpensive, but they were aimed at children. You know, it was largely children's programming, and so were a lot of serials, really. Oftentimes those serials were aimed at kids, you know, and dealt with, you know, sometimes a lot of elements of fantasy. Sometimes the subject matter could be a little lurid, you know, something to draw in the teenagers, I guess.
Yeah.
There were, you know, Westerns. There was a lot of, for the lack of a better word, maritime themed serials as well. One of my favorite maritime themed serials, Undersea Kingdom, Ray Crash Corrigan. And it's it was done in 1936. And if you watch it, some of the predictions of the technology that was available in the Undersea Kingdom itself, it actually did come true. I mean, there's some elements of television which had been invented, but was very crude, you know, at that time, make their way into Undersea Kingdom, and it's really a lot of fun. And Crash Corrigan was actually, you know, sort of a Western star. So it's kind of interesting to see him, you know, in this science fiction role. But then again, you know, science fiction does often borrow heavily from a lot of the tropes that you see in Westerns.
Yeah.
I mean, Star Wars is probably like the most shining example of that. I mean, it's just a horse opera in space, you know, essentially.
And they took a lot from the serials, too. That whole scrolling beginning, the way they
yes.
do the letters in Star Wars, that was taken from the old Buck Rogers serials, you know, exactly.
Well, it was, but a lot of different science fiction serials used that same scroll. I've been going through my copies today, and I saw the first serial version of Superman with Kirk Allen in 1948.
Yes, yes, sir.
And I've seen several others. And you know, that way of sort of, you know, drawing you in by having that scrolling text, always at an angle, you know, too. You know, it's at an angle to give it, I guess, some dimension. You know, on a flat screen, it's kind of hard to do, but it does give it dimension. And it does sort of draw your eye to it. It almost makes you want to read it, as opposed to it just, you know, scrolling up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but just by having that angle, by giving your eye something to catch. You know, it's fantastic. A lot of 70s and 80s science fiction films did that. And it all harkens back to the serials in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, those were great entertainment. I got into them. I would have found your site had you gone in that direction, but it would have taken me longer to, you know, because it took several years for me to start exploring to see what was online about the serials. But I have a passion for serials as well.
Well, and the serial, well, I guess I should say the movie that I'm running today as the movie of the day is actually Buster Crabbe's Flash Gordon Conquers the Universe. It's one of the edited versions.
Yes.
I would like to have put the entire version up, but I couldn't find an easy way to do that in archive.org. It does appear that they've got the single chapters available, but they're not in a format where I could easily string them together. So I just went with the edited version, which, you know, to tell you the truth, is probably enough. It's probably enough to you know, you whet your appetite, you know, to see more of it. It does, you know, for me, I'm so at this point so used to watching 90-minute films because a lot of B movies are 90 minutes or under. That, you know, watching, you know, something that has 15 chapters and a running time of 4 hours can be a little tough for me.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, I feel a little left out, I suppose. A lot of my friends, I have a lot of acquaintances who are, you know, I work in higher education, so a lot of my acquaintances are younger than I am. They think nothing of maybe taking a weekend and then binge watching an entire season of a particular show. I'm not that guy. I don't think I could do that. I need to watch so much of it and then kind of, you know, let it marinate, let me digest it, and see what I think about it so I can go on. So I think maybe that's another reason that I like serials is because they are in these little easy to digest snippets. And it doesn't overload your senses, and you can come back next week and then watch the next installment. But that's really, if you think about it, that's the way we grew up when we were
yeah.
watching television. There was no binge watching. You watched whatever show that you wanted, whatever show you loved. You watched it each week at a particular time, and if you weren't in front of the television to do that, well, too bad.
Yeah.
You'd probably be able to catch it, you know, as a rerun or something like that. But it also didn't seem as essential, you know, as it seems, you know. I mean, everybody wants to complete the set, if you know what I mean. They have to watch everything from beginning to end. And I understand that impulse, but I can't do that in one sitting. I've got to have more time.
Well, we can't. My wife and I have a custom. We spend some time at the end of the day before bed together. Usually we'll binge watch a series, so it'll take us a very long time to complete it. Right now, we're making our way through Supernatural, which was 15 seasons. So it's going to take us a long time to finish that. But yeah, we watch a couple episodes. Anywhere from 1 to 3, depending on how tired we are and how interesting the episodes happen to be. I can't sit and watch anything for very long. And even when we're watching the episodes, sometimes I'm working out, sometimes I'm doing dream interpretation while the episode is playing. So, I like that. And I remember as a kid buying the TV guide. And then getting the TV guide from the newspaper when my parents got the Sunday paper. And then I would sit down with a pencil and a pad, and I would read every single entry and write down, what I wanted to watch, and what days and what times we were on. And some I knew I couldn't watch because I was in school or otherwise something. And some of them were like 3, 4 in the morning. So those I had to sneak myself awake and, with a little flashlight. Turn the TV on really, really low, not to wake anybody, which was hard and not often successful. I remember those days.
If you had a pretty enterprising local TV station, oftentimes they would run movies, night long on Fridays and Saturday nights. Even when I was a kid and we did not live, near a major television market, you kind of had your choice. We had 3 or 4 channels that would run movies, all night Friday night and then all night Saturday night.
Yeah.
Some of them were themed. Saturday nights were usually reserved for horror or science fiction films, which is great. But Friday nights, you would get kind of a hodgepodge of things. It might be some old Universal comedies from the 1940s, maybe some Eurospy stuff from the 60s that I used to see, on television in these kind of random syndication packages. But they were all so entertaining. And even though you couldn't, like you can now, you couldn't call up exactly what you wanted to watch. It sure was pretty fun just flipping the dial and seeing what syndication package your local television station had bought into. And the ones that I watched, some of them were just wild. I have a huge penchant for French and Italian films, as you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those would make it into syndication packages because it was just so inexpensive to do it. They were dubbed, So as a child, I could understand them. But what a lot of fun that was. And I would stay up all night long and watch them. They usually went off around 6 or so, and that's kind of when I fell asleep.
And wrestling late at night in this area also. So they had weird wrestling, and you can catch that late at night as well as the peplums and the horror and the science fiction and, other genre movies. And it was awesome.
Well, and the wrestling shows were usually local. The ones that I remember as a kid, one of our local television stations, it was local programming. They shot it because they had the weather guy out there, calling the fight.
Oh, wow.
And it was really interesting. And they weren't like the wrestlers, like the WWF wrestlers and people like that from the day. These were kind of local people, maybe not in the greatest of shape or such, but it was local programming. And you know what? That's something I miss so much when it comes to television. There really is no local programming now. We live in the Pittsburgh market, and KDKA Channel 2 out of Pittsburgh probably does more local programming than the rest of them put together, quite honestly. But they're not really doing that much. But back in the day, a lot of the shows that you watched were locally programmed.
my start on television was on UHF, which is like local programming.
Mm-hmm.
But cable was around, so they used to rebroadcast the shows on the cable. And if you had people living in like particular boroughs who'd act as go-betweens, you could make copies. This is with videotape and three-quarter and before DVDs, and make the copies and send them to different boroughs. So you could like expand as long as you could find people and make copies. Recently when I wanted to start shows again, I was talking with a local station. So the way they had it was pretty much local programming, but they had networks online where they'd also broadcast it online, which is what the UHF station, I believe, did also.
Mm-hmm.
They're not around anymore. Last time I went to New York, I made a special trip to 23rd Street to see if the old studio was there. And it wasn't. And Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein, who now has a show on Mount Olympus, she also, she and I did shows together. We did weird cooking shows that mixed psychology and fantasy into them. it was a very wild time. I even conquering the airwaves at one point. So I went into her show with a sword and planted my flag and took over her show. And then I gave it back to her, but it was part of a protectorate that I formed with other shows that I'd taken over. It was a really wild and fun time. You couldn't get away with doing that on regular television, but this was like fringe television.
Well, and you know what? That goes back to B-movies. You could get away with more in B-movies and in series. Mm-hmm. And you really could with the big A-picture. That A-picture was going to be scrutinized. It was going to be censored. The B movie, especially when it comes to a 3 or 4 hour serial, I'm sure they were just letting things go. They just wanted to get through it.
Yeah.
And that makes them more fun too. And I think it adds more to their entertainment value as well. That it's almost perverse in a way that the cheaper your movie was, the more you could probably get away with. But it's true. And the same thing holds true with old UHF programming. It's sad that UHF isn't really around anymore.
It is sad.
There is no division of channels these days. UHF was just sort of tacked on in the 1950s. Initially, if you bought a television prior to 1952 or so. You just got, the 12 channel selector, and that was it. You got 2 through 13, and that was all.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the feds made them, expand it. And UHF was originally designed as being for, the purpose of education and public broadcasting and local, broadcasting as well. I never quite lived up to what it could have been, but does anything.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it was flexible. And again, I'll always be grateful for existence, because I had wanted to be on TV. I don't know if I shared this. Did I ever share my I want to be on TV story with you?
I don't believe so. No.
Basically, I decided that I was going to have a television show. And as with all things, it's like, I don't know how I'm going to accomplish this, but I'm going to accomplish it. So I did what I always do. I bought a notebook and a pen, and they became my show notebook and pen. So whenever an idea would come to me, I'd write it in there and so forth. I'd watch shows from a new angle to see how would I construct, how would I tell a story? So I decided I was going to do a variety type show and so forth. So I did this for like a year and a half before somebody actually invited me to be on a UHF cable show. And so up to then, I'd been interviewed like when they talked to you on the street a couple of times, the person on the street type of thing. But that didn't really count as being on television. So I was invited to talk about UFOs, which I was writing at the time a bunch of articles on and giving public talks about. So I went to the show, and the woman who had the show, and her show was pretty like notorious in New York. It had been spoofed on Saturday Night Live as well, you know. So it was, you know, all those like fringe UHF shows that combined metaphysics with the weird and the paranormal and self-help and dietary stuff, you know. So I went there, and she was in a panic. And I asked her what was wrong, and she had told me that her partner was just scarfed up by Jenny Jones. And Jenny Jones had a talk show. So her partner was a psychologist, and now she was on Jenny Jones as a regular person, so she couldn't do the cable show anymore. So she asked me, could I be a co-host? So I didn't know what that entailed, but I had perfect confidence in myself, and I had a notebook. So I said, yeah, sure, I could do it. If she asked me, had I ever done it before, I would have honestly told her, no, I've never done this before. This is my first time on TV. But she asked me, could I do it? And it's like, yes, I can do it. So that's what started it. I became a co-host, and that's how I met Dr. Barbara Becker-Holstein. And this went on for another year or so. And then the station was going to merge with a station in Yonkers. So they were telling all the people that their shows were dropped because, you know, they had duplicate shows. So even though I didn't have a show, but by that time I was a co-host on one of the shows, and I was a guest on, like, anybody who needed a guest. If I was free, I'd be a guest on their show. So I did also, you know, dating shows, political shows, psychology shows, paranormal shows, you know, you name it. I talked on the show. They called me into the office, and they told me they're merging, and I said yes. I was made aware of that to a lot of disturbed hosts, and they asked me what would I do if I had my own show. So don't forget, I had a notebook for a year and a half till I wound up on TV, and then I was on TV for like a year and a half on fringe UHF cable. But I had a notebook, and I wrote down all my ideas. So I pitched something I've been thinking about for like three years of thoughts, and they loved it. And that's how Thor the Barbarian, the show, came into being. And during the time it continued for around 3 years, it was their number one show. And it was a show that would most come up when they go and give presentations or talk to investors. They were known as the people who had Thor the Barbarian. So, but that's how it came about. And a lot of my inspirations were from the serials and from watching public television. And, you know, and so I'm very grateful that this public television existed, as I'm sure a lot of people will now be grateful to the internet. And you can compare the serials episodes that people do, like on YouTube.
Yes, you can. And I got to tell you, I have, well, for years now, I've been a YouTube junkie. But increasingly, more and more often, I find myself watching YouTube video that is you self-created. I mean, it's created by, you know, somebody who, like you just had a desire to do something or has a particular knowledge about a certain subject. And I think that's fantastic. Plus, what I've been finding out, even with the, you know, not great equipment that I have, you can do some pretty nifty special effects these days very easily with a green screen. I finally broke down since I'm on Zoom like all the time now. And, when I'm in a meeting or such, a lot of people will have like a clever, you know, background or usually something scholastic, you know, because I work at a university. And I bought a green screen to put behind me, and I always put up like a movie poster, you know, so always something from a B movie, typically.
Mm-hmm.
And it always generates a lot of comment. But the technology now has gotten so cheap. I mean, you can shoot some fantastic video on a cell phone, you know, or even a fairly inexpensive camera. I mean, I bought one a couple of years ago just to do some shots. I had an idea about a YouTube channel that I've never really gotten back around to. But I bought the camera for that reason, and it was less than $200, and it takes stunning footage. I mean, and so cheap. And the green screen that I bought was $20 from Amazon.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's that cheap. now, you know, and you can do some pretty good special effects. The green screen, and I can superimpose a photo behind me. It looks so good. It looks so much better than what you would think it would look. I think there are issues. I have issues, like the surveillance, some of the things that do go on in modern times, but the technology is just fantastic.
That is. I've even been playing around with ideas of doing like animation, some sort of animation. You could do more with like drawings than you can, like with effects sometimes. So I've been playing with that idea as well and writing little skits down. And I've been looking for animation software, and there's some things that look pretty promising. And again, it's my steep learning curve, but I'm determined to go in that direction, and I have a notebook now. So I'm writing these ideas down.
Isn't it interesting, even with all the technology that you seem to do it, I know I do it, the first thing that I reach for is a pen or a pencil.
Yes, me too.
I'm not going for my phone or my iPad or my laptop. I'm going old school. there's something about it that I think makes it more meaningful. That if you commit an idea to paper, manually, just using a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper, I think there's something in it that sticks in your brain more. It's called writing to learn, and I'm not sure if you prescribe to different learning styles and such. But for me, just personally, and I think this holds true for some people, if I write it down, not type it, but if I write it down, I'm so much more likely to remember it. I mean, I exist off of post-it notes and lists. I mean, if I didn't have those, I would never get anything done. I have a daily planner, and then it's covered up with post-it notes as well. But if I do commit it if I write it down, if I do commit it to a piece of paper, the chances of my remembering it, the chances of it staying fresh in my mind, are greatly enhanced just by doing that. And I find it interesting that you exist that same way. Having your notebook and committing things. I think there's just something about the act of writing it that I think gets the creative juices flowing. Kind of gets you in the mood. Do you know what I mean? In order to further explore that topic, it's just you can draw and sketch and along the way as well. And it only means something to you. It doesn't mean anything to anybody else.
And it need not, as long as it means something to you. And then a lot of ideas evaporate, and you never have them again. So if you have a notebook and you write them down, later on it's like, I remember this, or hey, this is a great idea. Haven't thought about this in quite a while. And I find it.
Yeah, I did the same thing. Yeah, I will wake up in the middle of the night and something will occur to me. The problem I've been working on would be easy to solve if I did it this way. And then I will immediately jump up, find something to write with and a piece of paper and jot it down.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I go back to sleep, I'm probably not going to remember it in the morning.
No. And you can fool yourself into thinking you will. I record my dreams for periods of time, then I'll stop for a while and I'll start. I've learned, and I have to keep relearning because I keep falling for it. I'll tell myself, I'll remember this. This is really cool. And then lie down for a little while and it's totally evaporated. It's gone. Nothing remains other than the fact that it's a really cool idea.
Yeah, I don't trust my memory that much. I don't think that I'm all that scattered, but, in some ways life is much easier now, but in other ways it's a lot more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You're expected to know more these days. If you're out, in the workforce, if you're employed, you're supposed to have sort of an encyclopedic knowledge of whatever it is that you're doing. And you do have that information at your fingertips, which is nice. But you're expected to be so responsible now,
yeah,
for all this content. And I mean, it kind of makes me a little scattered, you know. It can be kind of difficult, and you're not only supposed to be expert in one field; you have to be expert in 20 fields. So you're supposed to be a Renaissance man. You're supposed to know something about everything, and it makes it, for people like me anyway, it makes it hard to concentrate. You know, it makes it hard to focus on one particular thing. And, you know, the writing process is so important for that, because you can explore an idea, see where it goes, answer questions to problems that you've been kicking around for a long time. I think it's very important to write things down. I'm afraid that, you know, the generation that I'm teaching now, that's something that's, I'm afraid, going to be kind of lost to them.
Yeah, a lot of the newer generation don't even know cursive script or how to do cursive script.
They can't read it. I have written. You know, we have smart boards in the class. Well, I'm teaching online, but when I typically teach this course, I teach in a particular room that has smart boards on all four walls, and it has projectors as well. Well, it's handy for me to be able, you know, if I do have an image, you know, on the smart board, if I can just grab a marker and use things and make some notes about it. And I have to be mindful not to write cursive.
Right.
And that's my first impulse, unfortunately. When I started teaching, you know, back in the late 80s, I have pretty good penmanship. So I would always write in cursive, and now I can't do it. And my printing is not great. as nice as my script looks, my printing is just eh. I think my cursive is easier to read, quite honestly, but my students don't think so.
Right. Yeah, I found the same, and my printing's okay because I went to a Greek parochial school, and they had tons of classes on penmanship continuously. So I learned to print very well. So I'm grateful for that, I guess. But I remember when I was last teaching, and we used the computers too in Pennsylvania, and I learned then that they didn't understand script, you know, and it was very disturbing. And how much are you going to lose because you can't read, you know, cursive writing, because not everything is transliterated. You know, a lot of treasures are like people's notebooks with their creativity are in script.
That's true. And, you know, it is so much faster for me to write in cursive. You know, I can, printing seems like it takes forever for me to do. And in cursive, you know, I can write, you know, five times as fast. And but you're right, though. Everybody, no matter how much you practice, everybody's cursive script looks a little different. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's sort of like a thumbprint or a fingerprint. You know, it's your writing, and you can tell it. And you know, some people have beautiful penmanship. It's fascinating to read what they've written, because it's just because of the way it looks. And that's gone. And it's such a shame. I respond to the visual, to graphics. You
Me
know?
Too.
And I also respond to the written word as well. But I do appreciate graphics. No, I don't want just a string of emoji to tell me what I'm supposed to be doing that day. And you know, some of my friends that I text with, I mean, every other word is represented as an emoji.
Finally showed me how to do the emojis because I knew how to do the thumbs up, because that's there. And then it's very simple to do them. Now I'm just basically very resistant to using them beyond the thumbs up. And that's pretty much my main and only, in most cases, emoji that I'll use.
Well, you know, like anything else, I think it needs to be used sparingly. You know, you can overdo it. Some of it, I think, can actually enhance your message, and then after a while, it can get in the way of it.
Now, we're making a lot of changes. Like, for instance, retro sci-fi cinema is now retro sci-fi and horror cinema. I've been using the Brian Striven Theater in the title. We're planning our first specials. I just have to finalize the dates. I haven't heard back from everybody yet. We have two planned. One with George Helmer and Dave Dowling about Steve Reeves. So that'll be a combination Brian's Drive-In Theater on Steve Reeves' movies, and then it'll be Steve Reeves International talking about his workouts. And then we have with Bill Hinburn, and he's already verbally, he said he'd be excited by doing it, but I just got to peg down a date with him. He is the official dispenser and the guardian of the workouts of Reg Park. So to do the same type thing, and we're probably better off sticking, well, with Reg Park, we have no choice, but with Steve Reeves, sticking with Sword and Sandal, or even more specifically, Hercules, because, we only have an hour. But I'm really looking forward to hybrid shows. Even though we'll have covered some of the same ground, I think they'll be really unique, and really give people a fuller picture of these celebrities. And then I'm sure these guys know about other Sword and Sandal stars as well. So who knows what we've developed down the road. Maybe give people a proper
Sure. Well, and, Reeves, he influenced, how many different people.
Right.
I guess the thing that really blows my mind about it is that he was only in films for a few years.
Mm-hmm. As was Rich Park. Five of them.
Right. With so limited a filmography to influence that many people, to make that much of an impression on so many different actors, I think it's just amazing. I think that speaks volumes about both of the actors, really, Reeves and Reg Park.
I do, too. And if we didn't have Reg Park in Hercules in the Underworld or Hercules Against the Vampires, Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the audience watching that as a kid, and that inspired him to become a bodybuilder and an actor. So, that was Arnold's earliest inspiration. Then later on, he met his mentor and got to work out with him and then eventually beat him in a contest, he's always expressed gratitude to Reg Park for inspiring him and for taking a personal interest in his career and teaching him. So yes, the influence they had was phenomenal. Look at all the things Arnold, accomplished in his life. He started by being inspired by images in a movie.
And, he's 73, I think he'll be 74 this year. He's still relevant.
Yes.
I still see him in social media. I still see him around. And that's just kind of mind-blowing to me to think that, usually, I hate to put it this way, especially as I age, but by that age, you're looked at as being washed up. And that's not the case. He's far from it. And I know the story pretty well of how he was influenced by Reg Park. And he was watching Reg Park's best film, if you ask me. Hercules in the Haunted World is just, it's beautifully shot. It's well acted. It's got a great storyline. It has very interesting imagery and sets. If you were going to be influenced by a peplum film, that's probably one of the best ones that you could sink your teeth into.
That is very true, and I can't wait till we do the shows. In the interim, what do you call it? How can folks contact you, find your movies online, and anything new and exciting we have to look forward to?
Well, if you're interested in Hercules films, Sword and Sandal, or Peplum, or science fiction, horror, or if you're interested in old superhero films and serials, and comedies, we have some other genre as well. You can always go to briansdriveintheater.com. That's Brian with an I. And if you want to look me up on social media, the best place to find me is Facebook. I'm there all the time. And you can run a search for Brian's Drive-In Theater, and I'll come up.
Incredibly awesome. Brian, thank you so very much. And I'm greatly looking forward to our next conversation, which will be soon. It's the new month is almost upon us, and then we have those specials. So it's going to be an extra treat these next few months.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I need something to get me through this awful winter.
Same here. Be well, my friend, and I hope the new year is treating you well and continues to treat you well.
Thank you, sir, and we'll chat soon.
Okay, and thanks to everybody who joined us, whether it was live or later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. We are going to close with Mighty Elohim by Linnell Griffin.
With the baptism you belong, and with the